Welcome to The Swing,
Canadian political analysis for a global audience. I'm Yaroslav Baran.
And I'm Heather Bakken. The House of Commons got off to a late start this week, Yaro, with National Truth and Reconciliation Day on September 30th. The House resumed on Wednesday. This holiday is observed every year, and it directly links to a number of important political dynamics in Canada, including how the government interacts with Indigenous peoples in approving natural resource projects. Can you walk us through the origins of Truth and Reconciliation Day?
Yeah, it was established as a federal statutory holiday in 2021 following the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's calls to action. It's a day to honor survivors of residential schools, their families, their communities, and to commemorate the children who never came home from those schools. Now, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was established by the Government of Canada in 2008 as part of the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement. This goes back to the Harper government. The final report was released, though, in December of 2015, after years of work by the commission. So this is already early into the Trudeau government. And the report came out with 94 specific calls to action, you know, ranging from child welfare to education to commemoration to justice reform. And one of those recommendations was establishing this National Day of Remembrance and Awareness.
Yeah, and it's a day that everybody in Canada wears orange shirts to commemorate that. We hear a lot about this on the political scene now in Canadian public policy about the duty to consult. And it's starting to have a lot of reverberations. The current government, as we all know, established a new major projects office to fast track major nation building infrastructure projects. Can you unpack the principle of the duty to consult?
Yeah, it's an important and a complex principle in the relationship between the Crown, the Government of Canada, and Indigenous nations, particularly, as you say, in things like natural resources projects, the kinds of projects that we see occurring on, you know, what is squarely, you know, traditional Indigenous territories. Now, the duty to consult is a constitutional obligation of the Canadian federal and provincial governments to engage meaningfully with Indigenous peoples when a project may affect their rights, particularly Indigenous or treaty rights. The principle is defined by the Supreme Court through specific decisions on Indigenous appeals, going back to 04 and 05. It's rooted in protections for Aboriginal treaty rights under the Constitution Act and further refined through Supreme Court decisions. Notably, if you want me to totally geek out, the Haida Nation versus British Columbia case in 2004, the Taku River case in 2004, and the Mikisew Cree case in 2005, so far. And it continues to evolve with court decisions.
Yeah, and that underscores the complexity of this because there are several different treaties signed in at different times in our history, and it's complicated. So what triggers it?
So the duty to consult is triggered when all three of the following apply. First, Crown knowledge. The federal or provincial government knows or ought to know of a potential or established Aboriginal or treaty right. Second, contemplated government action. So the government making a decision, you know, approving a project or granting a license or changing land use. And the third is potential adverse impact. So the decision may negatively affect the Indigenous group's rights or use of land or cultural practices. So for example, approving a mining project in a traditional hunting area, even if that land isn't formally part of a reserve, but is traditional hunting land, could still trigger the duty to consult.
Okay, so what are the key legal principles at play here?
So the key legal principles are the duty is on the Crown, not on private companies, although companies are often required to assist, you know, for example, through engagement processes. Second, the consultation has to be meaningful. So it can't just be treated as a formality or like a box ticking exercise. Accommodation. Accommodation may be required. This means potentially modifying or mitigating the project to address the Indigenous concerns. And also, the depth of consultation is variable and project specific. So it's not a cookie cutter process. So it's a lower obligation when the claim is weak or the impacts are minor, and it can be a much higher obligation if the claim is strong and if the impact is significant. So in the end, and this is an important point to stress, the duty to consult is not a veto, and herein lies the political complication over this principle. Many claim it is a veto or ought to be a veto, whereas technically speaking, according to the jurisprudence, it is a high level of obligation that means very real things, but is short of veto.
Okay, so that's within Canada. Let's go beyond Canada. Canada signed on to the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It's also known as UNDRIP. And that document calls for free and prior informed consent. Does it supersede the Crown's duty to consult?
Canada has committed to a process of aligning its laws over time with UNDRIP, which, as you rightly point out, emphasizes free, prior, and informed consent. So in theory and practice, this raises the bar in what constitutes meaningful consultation and accommodation, but it hasn't legally replaced the Canadian legal test, which is consult, to requiring consent. And also, court rulings continue to refine the jurisprudence around the duty to consult principle. For example, the timing of consultation, the seniority of the delegation required in the talks, integration into regulatory processes, the degree of accommodation, and so on. So it's a living, breathing, and evolving legal principle.
And a rather complex one. So here, what's the bottom line?
I mean, the bottom line is that the duty to consult is a constitutional requirement meant to protect Indigenous rights from being infringed upon by government decisions. It is flexible, it's context dependent, and it cannot be ignored, even if the land is not formally ceded. Failing to meet this duty can result in a project being delayed or overturned or sent back for further engagement. Under political reality, though, the new de facto expectation is that Indigenous nations be brought into projects as equity partners deriving economic benefits from the projects on their lands. And this is the approach that the government is taking with Bill C-5 and the Building Canada Act and the Major Projects Office. This is certainly the government's stated intent to bring Indigenous nations in as full partners in projects.
Yes, and we've heard the Prime Minister actually use those very words. So how has Indigenous leadership been responding to this, though? Are they satisfied with how the government has been approaching it?
So far, they've been reacting with caution. You may remember there was frustration at the major project summit held between the Prime Minister and First Nations leadership this summer. There were numerous chiefs who walked out mid-summit, you know, criticizing the event as staged rather than a genuine, you know, dialogue. You know, some chiefs said that they expected more direct engagement, with the Prime Minister and with Cabinet, but found themselves largely talking to themselves and being talked to in presentations. So it didn't get off to a really good start, you know, tonally. Also, you know, the Assembly of First Nations National Chief, Cindy Woodhouse-Nipinak, has been quite critical that C-5, you know, this government's signature legislation so far, doesn't explicitly codify Indigenous consultations sufficiently. She was also actually critical that the Prime Minister didn't consult with her in naming the Indigenous Advisory Council that's supposed to be advising the Cabinet and the Major Projects Office in its work. So there is goodwill and sort of cautious optimism is too strong. There's a caution willingness to continue to work with the government, but with a big stress on the cautious.
Okay, so what are the next steps? Where do you think it will go from here?
I think where the rubber hits the road is how the major projects office actually operates. It's already announced its first major project, major project that is going to be facilitating a streamline to get them to get shovels in the dirt and getting them off the ground. But it will come down a little bit less to the legal foundations and more to practice. Does meaningful consultation occur? Do the affected First Nations feel listened to? Are they brought in sufficiently in their estimation as partners in projects and so on? So we're moving past the point of it being a legal principle and more into how is it applied and is it all talk or is it walk as well?
Okay, so thanks very much. That is a complicated subject to tackle, and you have, I think, spelled it out.
Yeah, we're going to be hearing a lot about this. You know, this government's policy direction is very, very heavily focused on resource development and, cross-national infrastructure projects. So this is going to be a principle that the government is confronting time and time again. And the next several years are going to see if the temperature comes down a little bit and if we come out of this with a more of a collaborative tone rather than one of caution and distrust.
Thanks, Jaroslav.
Thanks, Heather. Always a pleasure.